Good afternoon. We'll call this meeting of the Education Finance Committee to order. The first order of business will be the adoption of the minutes. Papa Brandon Peterson moves approval of the minutes dated January 27th. Is there any discussion, corrections, changes, or additions? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Members, we have two items on our agenda today. First is we'll be taking up, once again, House File 88. The second item for the agenda will be the Schools for Equity in Education will be offering their legislative priorities. So, Representative Depke, I'm not sure procedurally. I think we do need to do I need to move the bill a second time, or we can just continue it? Okay, well, Representative Dabney's telling me I don't have to do that, so we'll just continue with Representative Loon's motion that House File 88 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. But Representative Depke, you have the floor, and this time you actually get to decide who testifies and present the bill the way you want. And welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a pleasure to be back, and thank you for letting me present the bill in the order that I want it. I also want to thank all my testifiers who have come back today to testify for this bill, and I'm looking forward to a healthy discussion on the bill. Before we present the bill to you, I'd like to get it in the order that I would like to have it in, and that is I have an amendment, the A1 amendment, and it's simply, and that's in your packet. Simply what this amendment does is to change the title of the bill, which more correctly reflects the intent of the bill and what it does. And that is removing the current title and inserting that the title of the bill will be removing the maintenance of effort and set aside requirements for school personnel returning financial decision-making to school districts.
The chair will move the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion? Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, as is custom in this House, of course, I'll support the author in having the bill in the order that she wishes. But I am concerned that the language on line 1.4 of the A1 amendment is an editorial statement, not...
Representative Dabney?
Not something like factual. Okay. Substantive, statutory, it's an editorial, and I'm just not as comfortable with that being in legislation, and that's been a fairly consistent position for me for quite a while.
Representative Depke.
Quite honestly, that I feel that is an important part of the description of the bill. Representative Dabney, so I would like to leave it in.
Mr. Chair, just for the record, I made no motion to do anything about it. I merely made an editorial comment, I believe it would be.
and I do want to thank you, Representative Dabney, for saying that we do not have to reintroduce my bill. You helped speed this process along a little bit, so I appreciate that.
Is there any additional comments or discussion? If none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Depke, to your bill.
Okay. I have several testifiers today, and I will not. I will.
Representative Depke, my apologies. Yes. I just want to clarify. The chair was right. We did adopt the A1 amendment last time.
Oh, we did.
So, but that's. I don't think we nullified it by passing it a second time. So that's all right.
Good. I hope not.
Representative Depke, to your bill. My apologies.
Thank you for being for passing it twice. Mr. Chair, I'd like to just go through. I have several testifiers today. I have five or six people that have come back, and I appreciate that. But first of all, what I wanted to do is to talk a little bit about the bill, because I know it has gotten lots of attention. There's a lot of concern about it, and I want to just walk through some of the issues. The bill was passed in, it was 2007, and what it was originally intended to do was to allow schools to levy for school support personnel and related expenses for safety. And it also, in the last paragraph, it requires a maintenance of effort in not only number of personnel and dedicated finances to this particular area. what the law, 3 years later, what the law has shown to actually do, and my testifiers will discuss this with you, is to create actually a privileged group within our schools that cannot have cuts under any circumstances. The expense and some of the things that are in your packet have shown that it has turned out to be an unfunded mandate, because the amount that the school districts are allowed to levy for this bill is almost, I think, $2 billion above what is the finances that come in for this particular bill. It allows school districts to skip over protected support personnel when making decisions of either leave of absences or when they have to reduce staff in certain areas. So it's a seniority issue with our teachers and other personnel within the school district. The expenses in this particular area for the personnel designated can increase in the area but can never decrease. And finally, the most important in these difficult times, it creates a disincentive to hire additional support personnel. How does this law impact our students? It impacts our students is that while superintendents and school boards are looking at areas where they need to become more efficient and so forth, they are cutting to other programs, whether it's the arts, after school, technology programs, or foreign language programs. And in some cases, and this is where I originally got into the bill with one of my school districts, this was a 3 years ago, my school district in Orno came to me, and they had a beloved counselor who was retiring, and they had found a replacement for this counselor that they liked very much. They were not able to get someone who was as expensive as she was. That's the only way I can say it. But it was someone they wanted to hire that was making about $25,000 less a year than the counselor that was retiring after many years. And they were going to hire this new counselor, but they also needed a teacher in another area and could not use that $25,000 for a teacher in another area at that time. We were able to change the law 2 years ago so that you need to maintain the number of people in that field, not necessarily the dollars, which has helped some. I find now with some of our school districts have called me that when declining enrollment populations, had one school district who told me that they have two people that are allowed to be paid under this particular bill, and their school district with declining enrollment only really needs one, but they have to maintain the number of people in that area, and so therefore they are going to be cutting back in their elementary education area and actually increasing the teacher to pupil ratio in their elementary schools. The bill that I am authoring really eliminates the language in the final paragraph, which covers the maintenance of effort and the requirement to use the $3 per pupil levy towards salaries for particular personnel. And repealing this mandate will allow school districts the authority to do what is best for their student. And then also, as I said, return the final decision-making to school districts. I want to make a definitive comment. I, in any way, am not against nurses, counselors, or anyone that works with our students. I'm also not against teachers, principals, and others. I think that everyone in our school districts is important, and I think that it's very dangerous to put up a certain group of people and to allow them to be more important than anyone else. And certainly in these times, everyone's important. We all have to pull together to do that. And I haven't spoken to anyone, any of the schools, that said that they are not, they're going to fire counselors, that this is their opportunity to get rid of their counselors. What they're saying is they need the flexibility to make the decisions for who's going to be going to be in the certain positions in their school districts, and it's important to give that decision making back to the parents and the superintendents and the school boards of the districts that make those decisions. My first testifier is the Minnesota School Board Association, and I have with me Kurt Schneiderwin and Grace Kelleher. Kurt Schneiderwin will be testifying.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Kirk Schneiderwin. I'm on staff with the Minnesota School Boards Association, and Representative Depke and Representative Norton have framed the issue very clearly. I don't think that this is a complicated issue. I think the intentions of the original language had good meaning, good purpose, but I think in practice what school boards and school districts are finding is it's more complicated than that. And I think it's really important, as Representative Norton has framed yesterday, is that you need to separate the policy from the personnel. I mean, you ask any school board member or any school district administrator about the value that these people, the school support personnel, and they will all say that they play a very important role in what schools do. But it's the issue of the policy that challenges school boards when we go through the process of ULA. As we begin on February 1st, which is today, we're starting through that seniority process and certification process, that it becomes more complicated. And so when these people aren't included within that seniority list or the ULA or the certification list, it makes it more challenging for school districts in terms of their proposed reductions. I think it's important to understand that this, in a sense, has created a disincentive for school districts. I think the intention is to maintain the status quo. I think what has happened is quite in reverse, because what districts have done, and with the federal EduJobs aid that has come from the federal government, school districts actually were very reluctant to hire additional staff in this area because it would have required districts to maintain that effort going forward. So that's another issue that we're concerned about. We've had many districts who questioned this and called us and said, can we hire a half-time social worker? Can we hire a half-time guidance counselor? And our advice to them was very clear that the maintenance of effort requirement is an ongoing requirement, and that they need to be careful. If they have money in their operating funds going forward, then they could certainly do that if they plan for that. But they need to be aware of that as well. And as you know, that federal EduJobs aid is a one-time allocation. And I think it's also important to understand that districts are not going to immediately dismiss school support personnel. I mean, they are, by definition, they are teachers. We understand that. And we're not going to go through the process, if this provision passes, to the immediate dismissal of guidance counselors, school nurses, school psychs. That's not going to happen. I can assure you that. And I think, and I'll just conclude my comments there. And so if I have any questions, I'll certainly respond.
Thank you. And Representative Depke, is it your preference to have each of the testifiers speak and then take questions, or do you prefer to have questions at the end of each testifier?
It's quite all right. Mr. Chair, it's fine with me if someone would like to ask the testifier a question when they think of it.
Okay. So Representative Erickson is for this testifier? Or?
It's fine. It's for any one of them. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schneiderman, I've had counselors in my office, obviously, and I empathize with them. But why did this misunderstanding occur? Because in listening to Representative Detke's her explanation of the bill and your subsequent explanation, something broke down along the communications line for these folks to come to my office and plead with me not to support this. And it sounds like a logical local control, but what happened along the way? Can you help us understand that?
Mr. Schneiderwin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson, I don't have a good explanation for you. I think the issue is the issue of the maintenance of effort and the total that requires the total spending on services to be a part of that. And I think perhaps you'd have to ask the people who moved the bill forward, but I think that's where it got tripped up, is that they were trying to maintain the effort But in turn, what has happened is it's set a floor from which we have to work, and now we have to maintain that effort. Otherwise, school districts will get notified of that.
Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, is the School Board Association aware of any statistics as to how Minnesota ranks with the other 49 states in terms of the ratio of counselors to pupils?
Mr. Schneider.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Anzels, we are fully aware of that. And I think the point is, and I think it's something we're not proud of, we understand that issue, and I think the point is, though, we're not going to move down if we keep this statute in law, is that we're going to be required to create the disincentive for us. And so that's where I think that we need to understand, and that we're supporting local district, local flexibility in determining that.
Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just very briefly, frankly, I've been told that we're 49th. Mm-hmm. There's no place else to go. That's abhorrent. It's not Minnesotan. And that's why in 08 and again in 09, this provision was put into law. And I think it's irresponsible to repeal this at this time.
Well, hold on. We're going to go through the order. We'll come back. We all have good enough memories we can remember what people have said. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess Mr. Schneiderwin is leaving, who I was going to ask the question of, so I'll
come on
take my
down.
Time while he's coming back. You know, to me, there is no reason at all for this bill unless we're trying to be not 49th but 50th. And I'm wondering, I normally am, as a former school board member, am a flexible local control person. I try to be consistent. I did not support the statewide health insurance. I do not support the teacher pay freeze, but I will freely admit I'm inconsistent on this one. And it is because of the point that Representative Anzels made, that we're so low that this is just a finger in the dike against becoming 50th. And I can't imagine any reason for getting rid of this small amount of money and this small amount of, let's keep at least what we have in the way of school support staff, were it not to cut. So when Representative Erickson says, when people come to her office and have the idea that their jobs are going to be cut if this bill passes, I think the people in her office are right. Why would you want this bill if you didn't want to cut school support staff? And that's my question for Mr. Schneiderwin.
Mr. Schneiderwin.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Greiling, I'm not convinced that those folks would be reduced. I think the economic realities are that districts go through the ULA process every spring, looking at, based on the seniority list and their licensure provisions, and it's determined on that. And so perhaps you could make an argument that if those individuals fall within those seniority lists, that could be the case. But what we're finding out is that districts, because of this, are making choices by reducing others, art teachers, second grade classroom teachers, as a result of this. Now, in an ideal world, we wish none of that would happen. But that's the reality for school districts and school boards.
So,
Schneiderman, one quick question, Representative Greiling. You used the term ULA. Can you just explain what that acronym means for members of the committee?
Mr. Chair, that means the unrequested leave provision.
Unrequested leave of absence.
Yes. Thank you.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just wanted to summarize what Mr. Schneiderwin said. The reason for this bill, then, is to cut school support staff. Plain and simple.
Mr. Schneiderwind.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greiling, I don't think that's accurate. I think the issue is that there are requirements that school districts have to follow in terms of establishing the ULA process, and I think that districts will follow that process.
Representative Dufke.
Yes. I have my next... Representative Ward.
Well, Representative Dufke, we have right now, we've got Reinhardt, Erickson, Quam, Downey, and Ward. So this was your choice whether to...
I understand.
So do you want the testifiers to come down and then take the...
I think it might be helpful, now that we're into this process, if the chair would allow me to let all the testifiers come and then the appropriate individual who could answer the question, and it might be best. I do have...
Representative Depke, I think that's a wise choice. But we will make sure that those testifiers, please make sure that they are available to answer questions at the conclusion of their testimony.
Yes.
At the conclusion
Thank
of all testimony.
Thank you for your cooperation, yes. Mr. Chair. My next testifier is Scott Kronquist, and he's with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Scott Kronquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and we are here today to support Representative Depke's bill. We thank her for bringing it forward. I'll try not to be repetitive. Really, the high points have been hit. But let me say this. We do not support this bill because we think we have enough counselors in Minnesota, or because we think being ranked 49th in the nation in the student-to-counselor ratio is a good thing, because we don't think those things. And if there's anyone here that wants to introduce a bill to provide a funding stream so we can hire more counselors, we'll be first in line to help you out with that. All right? The reality is that the law that's on the books right now absolutely creates a disincentive for school districts to hire counselors or other support personnel. And I need look back no further than the $167 million that just came through the federal government to school districts through the EduJobs Fund that school districts could have used to hire counselors or other support staff. I am not aware of one of those positions that was hired with that money. And the reason is simple. School districts could not take one-time federal dollars and increase their level, their maintenance of effort requirement. Because when that money went away, they would be left then to have to use their dwindling resources to try to fill that in. It's as simple as that, Mr. Chair and members. So I'll leave it at that and be happy to answer any questions later.
Thank you. Representative Depke.
Thank you, Mr. Kronquist. My next testifier is Brad Lundell. He's with Seeking Equity in Education. Mr. Lundell.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell with Schools for Equity in Education. And like Mr. Kronquist, I won't belabor the points that have already been made. I think that there are a couple of angles here that I did want to insert, though, is that there's also an issue dealing with cooperatives. There was a school district that I worked with that moved their guidance counselors and support staff, or some of their guidance counselors and support staff, to a cooperative from their individual districts. And when they did that, they were cited by the Department of Education as being out of compliance with this law, simply because they moved the contracts from their individual school district. Same people moved to a co-op, contracts held there, district was viewed as not being in compliance. There was a bill last year to take care of that, but of course there was no education bill last year. Like Mr. Kronquist, I would say that rather than, if we want to be 49th, this is the way to stay at number 49, unless a bunch of other districts start cutting their school guidance counselors. Because we'll be 49th because of the MOA, we'll limit people from putting more investment into this area. And that's not to say that there isn't a need for investment in this area. It's just that the maintenance of effort is going to serve as a strong disincentive to put more people in this area into school districts. So with that, I'll just move to the next. You can ask me questions or do what Representative Depke wants to do with me. Just go from there.
Thank you. Representative Depke.
Thank you, Mr. Lundell. And then my next testifier is James Grashwall. He's from the Minneapolis Schools.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Jim Grashwall with Minneapolis Public Schools. This feels like a game show, you know, come on down. We strongly support the bill. I think this is a symptom, not a solution. And I think Representative Greiling's point, it's not that anyone wants to cut counselors, but the current law does is grant immunity to one class of, and so we're back on the survivor show, immunity to one class of employee, and not others. This year there will be cuts. The question is who and where. And I think you're going to be making those cuts, we're going to be making those cuts. The current law restricts our ability to exercise any discretion on that. Let's put the shoe on the other foot. And since we're in front of the Education Finance Committee, if there were a maintenance of effort in Health and Human Services, I think the members around this table would oppose that notion. That means Health and Human Services would be held harmless, and the $6.2 billion solution you need to grapple with would come out of K-12 education. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have, and I appreciate the author for bringing the bill forward.
Okay. Representative Depke, does that conclude the testifiers you have in favor of House Bill 88?
It does conclude the testifiers, yes.
Thank you. Well, at this point, then, we'll have everybody come on down, and you guys can play spin the wheel to figure out who's going to answer the questions that members have for you. So first on the list is we have Representative Breinert, then Erickson, then Quam, then Downey. And at that point, we'll give the opponents of the bill a chance to come down and testify as well. So Representative Breinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And really, anyone could take this question since you're all pretty much coming from the same perspective. But and it was answered. Someone mentioned the funding stream, but I personally understand that the MOA is a very poor mechanism for achieving the objective for which it's currently being used. But my reluctance to do away with the MOA is there is nothing else in place to address the concern for which the MOA has been put in place. And without some type of compensating mechanism, I'm not willing to remove the MOA. Even though, I mean, I understand what you just said about MOA on Health and Human Services, but the failure of that parallel is Health and Human Services is a very large portion of our budget, whereas the counselors in our school districts is a very small portion of our budget. So it's not quite a comparable rationale. The MOA is sort of, it's almost down to better than nothing. And it's a very inefficient and not maybe so effective mechanism for achieving the goal it's designed to achieve. But I guess my question to anyone who'd like to answer it is, what can we put in place instead of the MOA to achieve the objective of further supporting the role of counselors in our schools?
Before you answer, I know I speak for the entire committee, Representative Breinert, when I say no one wants to get rid of the Mall of America. It's the MOE, the maintenance of effort.
Yes.
So just to be clear. Although, in fairness, if Representative Lencheski were here, she may have a different opinion on the matter. Representative Depke.
I was just going to ask her what MOA was. So, but I will tell you, if you look at in your packet, that both the Minnesota Association of Superintendents put together along, and then Tim Strom helped format, and I think Representative Dabney had a question on this last time. If you take a look at the top line, when we talk about that the MOA is a very little money, actually, if you take a look at the total spending we currently have for all personnel in number six, is $202 million and $800,000. The $3 that the Safe School Levy gives brings in about $2.6 million. The basic maintenance of effort that was in place in 2007 when the mandate was put in, the requirement was to keep it at $193 million. The difference is $200 million that the school districts do spend right now on the total positions that are in that six. So, and the money that they are allowed to levy for that is $3 per student. So there is quite a bit of difference. It ends up being a $200 million unfunded mandate.
Representative Breinert, do you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate you pointing out that data. I guess it still doesn't address my concern to have an appropriate mechanism in place to support decreasing that ratio of counselor to student.
Representative Norton, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would say a couple things are in order. We did put a mandate in place a number of years ago, and there are other ways we could have handled that. The reason we did not handle them in the other ways is because it would have meant a funding stream which we have not, as a body, been willing to put towards school counselors. So what we have done instead is mandated something and put that onus on the school districts and have tied their hands. And was mentioned earlier about, I mentioned in my testimony last week, that we are 49th in the country, and that it's a sad place to be. I'm very sad about that. But the fact is, by this maintenance of effort being in here and schools being afraid to counsel, to hire any more, they're going to stay at 49th and maybe drop to 50th because they're not willing to hire more because their hands are then tied financially should they do it. So I think the term was used, disincentive. This particular provision is a disincentive to increase the number of counselors we have in the school without that funding stream. So my suggestion would be, if we really are concerned about this, and I've committed to the counselors that, you know, I personally hope we remove this maintenance of effort clause and then move forward with some legislation, some I've signed on to. Sandy Peterson, Representative Peterson, has a bill for high concern schools. But I just want to throw out the other example of Gary Kufall at Plainview Elgin Melville, who has a very tiny school district whose hands are tied. He is having to get rid of, you know, a single teacher. He has one first grade, one second grade, one third grade. He is having to combine classrooms because he can't manage this in his school district that small with having to keep the counselor that he has. And what he said is, I may not want to get rid of that counselor. I may want to drop her to half-time or him, I'm not sure what it is, in order so that I don't have to get rid of a classroom teacher so I have first graders in a first grade classroom. Those are the kind of tough decisions our districts are having to make right now. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I recall in 2007 I did not support this mandate for the reasons, some of which we're hearing now, because it was going to strap some small schools. But my question to either of you, if you can answer this, or a testifier, when this mandate was put in place, how many new counselors were hired within school districts across the state?
Representative, Deputy Representative Norton, or to the...
I was just going to say, did Mary Gilbert leave? She was here, too. So, but I'll have Jim, if you would like to come back and answer that.
Mr. Grathwell.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm sorry, I was filling my requirement to sign the ledger. What was the question?
Mr.
Chair. Representative
Erickson. Mr. Grathwell, after this mandate was put in place, how many new counselors, for example, did Minneapolis hire? Or if you have knowledge of any other district.
Mr. Grethel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I don't think I have a complete answer to your question. I have in this category 244 staff members. That's about 8% of my teaching ranks. In fact, so I don't have a great answer. I don't know for a fact if that number has grown, the 244 staff members in this support service personnel has grown or shrunk. I can get you that information.
Thank you. Representative
Deputy.
Yes. Representative Erickson, in the handout in your packet, and this was to Representative Dabney's question, was that in Minneapolis, which is the second number down after Aiken, shows that the total spending on positions is exactly the same today as it was in 2007. So that leads me to believe that financially that funding has stayed flat for the last 3 years.
We have Quam and Downey on the list. Representatives Loon and Greiling, we will come back to you after the opponents of the bill have had a chance to offer their position on the bill. So Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As it was touched on earlier, that when schools use cooperatives or find creative ways to adapt to the changing population demographics, that MOE makes it more difficult for them to be flexible and creative. Education districts have been very creative in trying to support special ed, special needs, when you have multiple small schools that cannot have full-time staff. And I think that this kind of super tenure prevents the school districts, especially in outstate, to fulfill their requirements and to be able to fulfill the needs of their students. And on principle, I support the local control and flexibility and creativity, and I stand against any form of super tenure that outlives the position of a teacher with tenure.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure if any of the testifiers could answer where we were ranked before we put the maintenance of effort into law in terms of our national ranking.
Representative Deppke.
Kurt Schneiderman, can you? Thank you.
Schneider win.
Mr. Chair and Representative Downey, I'm not exactly sure, but I would guess that we were probably 48th to 49th in that ballpark. I mean, without having any solid information on that. So I can certainly dig into that and get back to you.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just was curious whether the statutory mandate had started to show some of the desired effect, which would have been a higher ranking relative to national trends. And I was just looking at the sheets here, and Cloquet's got almost 7 FTEs on this. Eden Prairie only has 5. My district has 40. I'm just guessing that even these headcount numbers and some of these ratios that we're talking about have a lot to do with the way people categorize slices of time in their building and what have you. So I don't know. It doesn't seem to be to me that there's any evidence that the mandate has actually had the desired effect. In fact, it probably looks like people are kind of managing numbers to make it look one way or another, and we should just let the districts do what they want. We haven't heard a single piece of testimony from a school district saying that this thing has actually increased their hiring. In fact, it's doing the less or the reverse. So we can hear the testifiers against, but boy, just assuming that this mandate is actually working or would somehow work in the future, it doesn't seem to be any evidence to that. So I'd support Representative Deppke's bill.
So, and members, I had mistakenly forgot that Representative Ward got in before the line came in, and I did not have his name written down, so my apologies. So, Representative Ward.
Mr. Chair, I'm a small guy. I understand you overlooking me. thank you for recognizing that fact, though. You know, those of us that have been in the classroom on this committee, those of us that have actually been an educator for whatever number of years, you know, we've often seen how our support personnel make a difference in the lives of the kids outside of the academic area. Our kids are, our students nowadays are a lot different than they were when in 1973 when I started educating and teaching our children. And the demand on our schools and our personnel, our education personnel, has increased significantly, whatever classroom it is. And we've all witnessed the impact that the support personnel, you know, I was a health and FIAD teacher, I was an EBD teacher, I was an LD teacher, I was a service learning teacher. I taught a lot of different areas. But I oftentimes asked our support personnel, guidance counselors, nurses, social workers, to help me with a child. And we've all witnessed that, those of us that have been in that classroom. And we witnessed the amazing things that they've done. And I submit that even some of that support personnel has saved our society and our taxpayers significant dollars through some of their emotional help, their social help, their health help, period. You know, I want to talk about incentives. I heard Grace Keller last week say, or I think it was last week, say that if we repeal this, in fact, school districts are waiting to hire more counselors, is what I heard. And Ms. Keller, you correct me if I'm wrong, but that's what I heard. I heard you say that school districts are looking to hire more counselors if we repeal this. I just want to ask the question, the simple question, of what superintendents or boards are on record of saying, we're going to hire more if this is repealed. I just would like to ask that question.
Representative Deppke, to
yes.
Your supporters.
Would Grace Kelleher like to answer that question?
Ms. Kelleher, welcome back to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Grace Kelleher, and I work for the Minnesota School Boards Association, and Representative Ward was right on the mark. I did say if the maintenance of effort was removed, it would allow school districts to actually look at bringing on counselors. I made it in reference into the federal jobs money that we just received in the state of Minnesota. That is a one-time source of money, and as such, could not be used for counselors because of the maintenance of effort. And it's that kind of foolishness in law that really holds back local boards from doing the right thing. And Mr. Chairman, we've asked you to remove this. It's been on our list of mandates for many years. And I think and I encourage the committee to open their ears to their local school districts and local superintendents on this issue. It's not a turf. It's not a battle. We respect what all the teachers do. Whether they're a counselor, whether they're in first grade or in high school, they all do a service for our children. We don't look forward to cutting. I'm sure you guys don't either. But the economic realities of the situation cannot be ignored. We need to pass this bill in order to provide local flexibility and let us look at thinking about adding counselors in the future and not just staying static because of the limitations of a state law enacted by people who were trying to do the right thing but evidently did not find the words to do it appropriately. It's unfortunate the counselors were advised of.
So, Representative Mariani, we're going to move on to the opponents of the bill, but then we should have time for you to be able to come back with Representative Loon and Greiling on the list. So thank you, Representative Depke, and to the testifiers. Mm-hmm. Now, on the list of testifiers, I have, I know Mr. Campo has already spoken, and Dr. Roberts is here, but Mr. Campo, if you'd like to come forward, you're welcome to as well. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record so that 100 years from now we'll know who you are. not we.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. My name is Walter Roberts, Jr. I am a professor of counselor education and professional counseling programs at Minnesota State University, Mankato. And it's nice to look around the table. There's a lot of you I know. I look forward to meeting some of the rest of you as the legislative season goes by. I have a prepared statement, and I have some information that will answer some of the questions that have come up today about where Minnesota has been over the past few years and provide some other background information with exactly some of the items that have come up today. But I tell you what I did on the way up. I decided that rather than just necessarily read my prepared statement, I thought I'd make some changes in it. And so some of my prepared statement will be in the packet that you see, and then I want to try to perhaps answer the question with regard to putting a different spin on the question of exactly what an incentive might happen to be for making sure that we maintain maintenance of effort. I'd like to ask all the members of the committee and the people in this room, what is the real value that we place on safe schools and on healthy kids? We've already heard today that some of the issues that kids come to school with, and we know that. We know that kids come to school hungry. We know that they come with any myriad number of problems that negatively impact their ability to learn. Some kids come, they've been abused. Other kids come, they create discipline problems in the classroom. They disrupt classroom learning. Many times they're potentially harmful to themselves or others. And as much as we would like to take that pain away, and as much as we would like to perhaps make it otherwise, we also know that many children and adolescents that are in our schools are in the early throes of developing long-term mental health problems. School counselors and student services personnel are some of those people that are in the front line of defenses to try to intervene to prevent these problems from getting worse. These problems did not appear overnight, and they will not go away with budget cuts. Please remember that. Last week I did what I call a snapshot survey. It was a convenient survey of individuals on a statewide listserv. I just kind of wanted to get some background information so that I could come in here and share some information with all of us with regard to the issue of what school counselors are seeing in their schools right now with regard to potentially self-harmful behavior. And you have a copy of just a little summary of what they reported back to me. This was a very small sample. I claim no scientific structure behind it, but this is what they told me that they had seen over the last 2.5 school years, and this goes up to this school, the current school year. Out of 31 school districts that responded, There had been a total of 157 suicide attempts that the school counselors in those districts were aware of in 31 school districts in 2.5 years, and there had been a total of 8 suicides. Now I want to take that number of 31 responding school districts, and I want to lower the number to 25, because 6 of the 31 school districts that responded had indicated that they had no suicidal behaviors or suicide. So basically what I'm saying here is that the numbers that you're seeing here is really only out of 25. I bring that to our attention because this snapshot is of only of a very small number of school districts. If you take these numbers and magnify this by the number of school districts that we have in our state, we are, if these numbers were to hold true, and I cannot claim that they will, because obviously this was a very, very small convenient sample that responded to the questions. But if you do the math, we are well on the way to having more, in some school districts, more suicide attempts and more active and more suicide completions than we have had in years past. Maintenance of effort was designed to stop the hemorrhaging within Minnesota schools from further reducing its student services personnel. Maintenance of effort truly has only been in effect for about 1 full year. If I'm not mistaken, it actually only was enforced beginning this school year. The state has not yet had the full opportunity to keep a minimum of school counseling and counseling-related services within the state to prevent the situation from getting worse. What we do know is this, with regard to the argument and with the issue of local control, is that maintenance of effort related to school counseling services and in favor of local control has landed us consistently at the bottom of the heap when it comes to the provision of these type services. And the whole idea behind maintenance of effort was to stop this slide. I have not heard, like many of the opposing side, obviously, because we have a disagreement, where individuals indicate that they have not heard any arguments about why not to do away with maintenance of effort. I can honestly say that I sit in the same position on the other side, and I would say I've not heard any convincing arguments to do away with it, primarily from the standpoint that we heard testimony here just now that went from, I can assure you that there will be no cuts, to, well, I'm not really sure that there will be any cuts. And we've heard, if you listened, you heard that transition right here in front of us with regard to the testimony that we had. So again, in closing, I ask, what is the value that we place on safe schools and healthy kids? What are acceptable losses for our children and families by not maintaining a bare minimum of safety and prevention and standards that school counseling services can provide to help not only the kids, but the teachers in the classroom do what they like to do best, which is teach kids and help them learn? I ask you respectfully to vote no against the repeal of maintenance of effort. There are times that government has to step up to the plate and do the right thing, and this is one of those times. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. And Mr. Campo, did you have any additional testifiers besides those who testified at the previous hearing? No? Okay. At this time, then, we'll take questions for the doctor, and then we will go back to our previous list. Are there any members who have questions for the doctor or for Mr. Campo? Representative Woodard, were you on for this one, or was it, okay, Representative Woodard, then Representative Mariani.
Yep, and thank you for your testimony. Mr. Chairman, I have a quick question on the school district Safe Schools Maintenance of Effort data. This Excel spreadsheet we have here indicates 2,810 FTEs, and this the sheet you gave us has 1,101. Can you explain the difference between those two?
Yes, and Mr. Doctor. Chair and Representative, thank you for the question. The data that I have given you is specific to school counseling personnel, according to data that's reported to the U.S. Department of Education. My assumption is, having only seen the data that was presented here when I walked in the room, my presumption is that the numbers that you were presented from the State Department of Education includes school nurses, school social workers, school psychologists, and school counselors as well. I don't know that because I haven't had a chance to analyze the data further. That's my assumption.
Representative Woodard.
Well, just as a quick follow-up, and this may be for Representative Depke. So what this is telling us is that we have 2,810, and it could be counselors, nurses, all the other safe school personnel that could be under there.
That's
so
correct.
Really what we're not doing is, as it exists today, the MOE really is not about school counselors. It's about the entire makeup.
That's correct. The counselors, the school nurses and social workers, school psychologists, are all licensed people in under the bill, and those are the ones that are under the maintenance of effort. Information that I passed out, the numbers, does not include the cost of the police officers and other support personnel and related to the sheriffs and liaison with the school district, the pay for costs for drug abuse prevention programs and any personnel that are involved in that in the elementary schools as well. So if you take a look at the information that the Minnesota School Boards Superintendents Association put together, you'll notice that in 2007, where the maintenance of effort went into effect, the schools were not even levying for this particular bill, because the levy that they get is up to $30 per pupil, unless they're a part of an inter-district. And then they can levy for $40. But if you'll notice that at that time, it was $193 million without this maintenance of effort. Today, it's $202 million. And with the maintenance of effort, and the difference is that these school districts at that time, even without the maintenance of effort, were willing to pay almost $200 million for these people, not even including the police officers. And so this is an important issue in this state. It's not that these school districts are not interested in it, because without the maintenance of effort, they were doing it anyway.
Mr. Campo, Dr. Roberts, this is supposed to be the time for the opponents of House Hall 58. Did you have a rebuttal to them? Or did you wish to offer one? Or it's your choice. I don't feel like it's required. I just feel like this is the opposition's time, and we kind of... Mr. Campbell.
Okay, members, Dan Campbell, and of course I represent the Minnesota School Counselors. You know, a couple of different things. First of all, let me go back to the bill line 2.16. You can go 2.16 through 2.18. The arguments that have been that I've heard today, a couple of different things. One, I have heard, you know, we'd hire more school counselors. I've also heard we need the ability to make cuts where we see fit. I get that. Again, you've already heard the maintenance of effort is establishing a bare minimum. Yes, it's a mandate. Yes, it's establishing a bare minimum. But when you really take a look at things like the representative's argument, who's carrying the bill, that the district came forward to her and said, look, we have a retiring counselor. We're not able to hire anyone back at that pay grade. If you read the legislation, at 2.16, it does say, or... the district's full-time equivalent number of employees. So this is not an and, it is an or. So that argument really is null and void, because the district would be able to hire back someone as someone retires to cover that position, so that the students have access at those minimum numbers. But they don't have to hire them. The choice on what they hire is not what anything it says in here. Another piece of this, just to understand, again, we keep talking about, I keep hearing people are willing to hire counselors. Keep in mind, this language didn't go into effect until this year, just a few months ago. So we have given it less than a year to take effect at a minimum standard, and people are coming up still arguing for greater cuts. We are talking about basic safety here. Other things I just would stand for question on. I think Dr. Roberts summed this up fairly effectively. So,
Representative Mariani. Oh, no? Okay, Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pardon my ignorance on some of the way these positions are counted, but I was a little confused by the combination of answers given to Representative Woodard's question here. So in that 2,810 FTE count, are in fact the other safety and security-related positions included in that number, or is that really just the counselors and nurses and psychiatrists, et cetera, in the schools?
It's a the any of the three people at the table. Representative Depke.
I'm going to have Valerie Doslin from the Minnesota Association of Superintendents for this for the state answer that question, since these are her numbers.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Doslin. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Doslin. And in this case, I'm representing the Minnesota Association of School Business Officials, which put this document together. And I know there were some questions last week during the hearing, and I apologize, I was not here. I had to be out of the Capitol for a meeting. So this information, my understanding was the school business officials took off of the summer levy data sheet that the schools are required to report to. And the full-time equivalent number is just licensed school support personnel, which are school counselors, school nurses, and school psychologists.
Well, Mr. Chair, just an observation, if I...
And school social work, excuse me.
Ms. Doslin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I mean, I'm just doing some rough math, and we've heard repeatedly that we're 49th, and I get that I probably don't understand the differences in counting here, but I just did a rough ratio of 2,810 to the total number of students, and we actually had 297-1, which would place us 8th in the nation. So somehow, I'm not sure. I'm not understanding enough. I'm going to rely on the testimony of the school districts to say that they would prefer to have this maintenance of effort relieved, and I think we'd do well to not rely on this 49 position number, given that there's so much confusion around the data. Thank you.
Dr. Roberts.
Mr. Chair, I want to be very clear. I'm sitting here. The numbers, I can't speak for these numbers. I haven't seen them until I walk in the room. I don't know the origin. I can, however, speak to the National Center for Education statistics that I have in my hands right here, and I can tell you the number of school counselors in the state, according to the 2008-2009 data, was 1,101. The issue I think that is important for members of the committee to understand and keep in mind is that different student services personnel have different functions. School counselors serve students in the school with the academic, personal, social, and career focus. They serve all students in the school. School social workers, school psychologists are primarily involved with working with special education. And, of course, school nurses serve everybody as well with regard to health-related problems. So there is a delineation within the different student services personnel. And it is, I think it is an error, no disrespect, but it is an error to try to glob all of those together because and come out with a ratio that looks different with regard to the issue of the different services that are provided within the school settings.
Representative Depke, at this point we're taking opponent's viewpoint, so we didn't give them instant rebuttal when your supporters were in favor of the bill. It doesn't seem fair to give them instant rebuttal. Are there any other questions for Dr. Roberts? Thank you very much. This is a public hearing. What? Oh, Representative Anderson, there's a question. My apologies.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question, I want to go back to the handout we got, the School Safe District Maintenance of Effort for 2009. I just had a question of clarification. A lot of the schools here, Minneapolis, for example, spent the exact amount of money that was their basic MOE effort. But going down the list, I just picked out 0016 Spring Lake Park spent $1.15 million. And their MOE was about $950,000. Is it safe to assume or correct to assume then that the following year their MOE for Spring Lake Park would be this $1.15 million?
To any of the people at the table, we'll take that as a neutral question.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, Representative Anderson, I didn't hear what school district you mentioned.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, was Spring Lake Park 0016, just as an example?
Yeah, my understanding is that the document, the maintenance of effort that they need to meet is the 959, the fourth column over, the 959,000. They spend more than 1,150. Mike can give you another example of a school district, Osseo School District 279. They currently spend 7.273 million. Their maintenance of effort was 6.473. And while I don't have the exact number in my head, I know the Osseo School District received a federal grant to hire some additional counselors a few years ago, and that grant is about to expire. So I am assuming that that number is reflective of the additional federal grant dollars they received.
Mr. Strom, how about you enlighten the committee? What do you think about this?
Mr. Chair, members, there's two parts to the whole harmless. It can either be the total dollars spent or the amount spent, the same number of FTE for those positions. And while I myself am not familiar with the basis for these numbers, that's my guess between the difference. Because, for example, in District 16, if Spring Lake Park had an older counselor who retired and hired a young counselor, they could go off their FTE and the lower salary base. Rather than off the salary number, so it's either the lower of your keep maintaining your FTE count or the total spent on those positions. So that's my guess. What explains part of that difference is that the districts have a choice: lower FTE, you know, same FTE as previous, or same dollar amount, whichever is lower.
Representative Anderson,
thanks, Mr. Chair. So it's not totally correct to say that if they spent more money, that doesn't automatically become their base for the following year.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, it would be their base if their FTE was not changed. But it's not totally correct to say that. But if they spend more, it's going to push their base up unless they can also do the count on the basis of FTE. So if they had the same number of salaried staff, 15, for example, doing those jobs, and their salaries went up 5% from one year to the next, that higher 5% would not be required in the maintenance of effort. The 15 would meet the maintenance of effort.
Mr. Campbell, did you have something to add?
You know, if I understood the question correctly, maintenance of effort was at a 1 point something, it sounded like 1,000.1, and we talked about the amount that the Safe Schools levy at the $3 funding was somewhere around 900 or so. That's an additional $3 that what didn't exist until actually 3 years ago. So technically, the districts have had the option in getting the additional money. So the total amount, while maintenance of effort may be at one point something million, as it appeared to sound, that was money that they already had existing in the budget. So in many ways, this bill, as it, not House File 88, but the legislation as it currently enacted, offered relief with the $3 per pupil to their basic and existing budget. And since there we can't find any other counselors that have been hired under that, it appears that at status quo, the districts have been able to see some financial relief with this additional $3. And, of course, it was always offered as an incentive to hire more of these people. Now, if they chose not to hire, then where did the $3 per pupil go? And because they got it into their budget.
So allow me to translate, because I speak Republican, Representative Anderson, is that, and I actually have the same question you do, that when I see that the basic maintenance of effort number is lower than the current amount of spending, by definition, wouldn't the current amount of spending then become the maintenance of effort dollar amount?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the question Representative Anderson was asking. So we're trying to figure out, it would seem that column total spending on positions and basic maintenance of effort requirement, those numbers should be identical throughout the entire spreadsheet, unless districts have had a surge in spending in which this is a year-old maintenance of effort number. Representative Anderson, is that the question you were asking?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
And Valerie might want to verify this, too. Is Mr. Strom still there? It's my understanding that the total spending, which is in the far left column under the count number, is the $202.8 billion. That's what the total spending is as of currently. The state school levy, which is the $30 per pupil, comes to $2.6 million. Right. In the third column over, under basic maintenance effort requirement, that was what school districts were spending in 2007 when the maintenance of effort went into place. The difference between what they're spending today of the $202.8 million minus the maintenance of effort requirement, which was begun in 2007, equals the difference. So school districts are actually paying $200 million for maintaining the maintenance of effort, and that has already taken into account the Safe Schools levy, which is only $2.6 million. So if you take the $202.8 minus the $2.6, you get $200 million.
Okay. Mr. Strom, the So with regards to the basic maintenance of effort requirement and total spending on positions, I don't want to speak for Representative Anderson here. We understand how the number can go lower by meeting the FTE requirement. But how does the number go higher without the maintenance of effort spending requirement increasing?
No, Mr. Chair, no, it doesn't go higher unless the spending or the count goes up.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative
Hold on 1 second. I just want to make sure, Representative Anzels, that we want to close up the sort of the opposition to this. Is this a question? Okay,
yeah.
So because otherwise we have to move you over to the general waiting queue.
I'll be quick.
Of course, Representative Anzels, go ahead.
I have found it extremely difficult, if not dangerous, to try to predict the behavior of 436 school superintendents and locally elected school boards. We've heard from Minneapolis, we've heard from the metropolitan area. I wonder what they're thinking in Badger or Grigola or Northolme or small school districts that don't get an opportunity to be here. And secondly, I'm wondering how it can be. This is the first time I've ever heard this here, that by reducing a levy, ending a levy, reducing local property taxes, will result in the magical event that more people will be hired to provide more government services. Reduce levies, more employees. How does that work?
Representative Depke, does your bill reduce levies?
No, it doesn't. Representative Anzels, first of all, I agree with you. This is what this is all about, is that I don't know what's right for your school districts. I know what my superintendents tell me for my district, but it couldn't be any more different than yours. And I'm thinking about all the districts in the state just like you are. This does not reduce the levy in any way, shape, or form. What it does, it allows them to use that money in any way that they see fit. And it's interesting to me that, may I go beyond Representative Anzels and speak?
Representative Depke, why don't we do this? First of all, thank you, Dr. Roberts, Mr. Campbell, for your testimony. This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify either for or against House File 88? Welcome to the committee, member of the general public. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman and members, Sam Walseth. I represent the Minnesota Rural Education Association. We are supportive of House File 88, so I don't know if it's appropriate to speak at this time or how you want to proceed. But I was interested by Representative Anzel's question about the impact in greater Minnesota. I guess while I'm here, I'll just keep going. There are some small districts that experience major enrollment changes. I can think of one district in particular, Westbrook Walnut Grove, that a decade ago had a new Hmong Americans came to the district and increased that district's enrollment from about 430 students to 590. Wonderful influx of students, revenue for that district kept them afloat. Those students are graduating this year. And that district is going to go from 590 students this year to 430. That's about a 25% drop in enrollment and a significant decline in revenue for that district next year. And they need as much flexibility as they can to restructure their program in that building. And all staff need to be on the table as they put that program together. And that includes school support staff, too. And this maintenance of effort, if we don't get this law change, is going to prevent them from doing what they need to do best to meet the needs of the kids in our community. So we need some flexibility.
Thank you. All right, so we're back to the... first of all, any other members of the general public who wish to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, then we'll go back to the general queue for questions from members. We have Loon, Greiling, and Dabney. Representative Loon.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Depke. I want to thank you for bringing this forward. And it honestly, and from my perspective, and we all come to this looking at the issue as a whole and also looking at our individual school districts, I think, to be honest with you. I have some questions, and I'm not sure if it's best to direct them to you or to our researchers, because looking at those charts and that, I look at sort of the various neighboring school districts around mine, and Eden Prairie actually is showing at a fairly astonishing low level. And I'm wondering if it's possible that the personnel that we're talking about are counted differently. I've been in all of my schools frequently, and I'm fairly certain we've got more than five school nurses, counselors, et cetera, et cetera. Is it if they are falling into some other category, or it's a licensure issue, or is there something I'm maybe missing here?
Mr. Strom, can you account for data that you did not create and describe?
Unfortunately, no. I don't know the source of that data or what exactly it's measuring. So this data was originally put together by MASPO, and they had some printing issues, so I simply reformatted it to print them for them, but I don't know the origins of it.
Representative Duffy. I do have Valerie Doslin from MASPO here to answer any questions that you have along the data her group put in.
Ms. Doslin, did you hear the question from Representative
Lynn? I did. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, members, Valerie Doslin from the School Business Officials. This data was taken from the Minnesota Department of Education's summer levy tracking spreadsheets. The MASPO took the information and then put it in this document, which we had some problems reformatting it, and House Research did reformat it, but just to be clear, House Research did not have any role in putting the data together, but this was information that was provided through the Minnesota Department of Education that MASPO put together.
Representative Lynn?
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, Ms. Doslin or Representative Debke or to our researchers, so would these personnel possibly be only those who were hired or subject to the levy? Is it possible that school districts are, you know, have personnel that are doing this work that were, it was going on before the levy was allowed, or am I mixing apples and oranges here?
Ms. Doslin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Loon, this certainly appears to be an anomaly, so I think that we will actually need to talk to the business manager in Eden Prairie, find out what the specifics of the situation is.
Okay.
And I will follow through with you directly on that.
Okay.
Representative Greiling.
Representative
Loon, I thought you were done.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd appreciate that, and you know, I don't know if it'll help for our discussion before. I mean, I think in listening to the testimony, all of our districts are in difficult situations, and, you know, while I may agree or disagree with an individual school or principal's decision on how to handle a kind of a shortage issue of not enough resources to go around and how do you handle it appropriately, you know, may change from situation to situation. But, you know, overall, I know my own school district is struggling with, you know, how do we meet the needs of students with a lack of resources. And certainly the counseling issue is one that's important, and I have heard from a number of constituents that, you know, as our students' populations change, the different needs of the students change, and it's becoming a triage situation in some schools where, students who just want to go in and get some advice about college or courses they should take to go to college and that are not usually or not often getting counseling appointments because it's for students with greater, perhaps, emotional needs or something going on in their family life that they need some counseling over. So I have concerns about that. However, I'm not sure from the legislative standpoint, unless we've got some other options for schools, that we are in the best situation to tell them exactly how they're going to have to organize their school personnel. So from that standpoint, I am inclined to support flexibility for them. Final question, Mr. Chair, has the school counselor FTE count always been something that's been reported as part of the information that the school districts send to Department of Education and is publicly reported for parents or other interested parties to compare?
Mr. Strom, is that data reported to been reported to MDE on a regular basis?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, I don't know the specifics about that, but generally speaking, the license data that's reported for licensed staff lists the thing that they are licensed for. So to the extent that school counselors are licensed as school counselors, they'll be on the department's list of of staff, and those files are referred to as the STAR files at the Department of Education. So my guess is that counselors are in their own category and have been reported for a number of years because of the specific nature of their licensure.
Representative Loon.
And would that mean, if they are reported that way, that they are operating or serving in that particular capacity at that school district?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, not necessarily. It would mean they hold that area of licensure, but not that they're performing that function.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was my assumption. Thank you.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think a lot of us are agonizing over this because we all support counselors, and I think most of us realize that the maintenance of effort isn't the perfect legislation because it wasn't accompanied with new funding except for $3 on the safe school levy, which we've all acknowledged is a drop in the bucket compared to what we need. And so so we're left with this vote here today. But I stay in agreement with myself for my earlier statement that there's no reason that I've heard from all the testifiers to pass this legislation but for to cut school support staff. And some have given an argument that the EduJobs money could have been used for counselors, but, you know, to me that's a non-argument for anything because it's one-time money. If anyone hired school counselors, they would have to be cut later. So that's another argument for wanting to cut school support staff. If you wanted to hire them, you also wanted to cut them immediately before they hardly got situated. So I think we're all here about this is a vote whether or not you want to cut school support staff or not. If we just wanted to accommodate the small schools that Mr. Walseth is talking about that had extreme change in enrollment, we know we could have legislation just to do that. But this is a bill to cut school support staff wholesale across the state. So I would like a roll call.
A roll call has been requested. Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, with the assistance of Chair Erickson, I answered my own question. Thank you very much.
Those are the best sorts of questions to ask, aren't they, Representative Dabney? Representative Slocum.
I have been patient. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't raise my hand, so you did not recognize me.
Of course.
I'm going to put a human face on it because all we've talked about is numbers, and that angers me. I thought we were here for kids, and I just want to remind you about that. Tim, I teach eighth grade. Tim. I told him his father had been murdered. My favorite student took 4 bullets to the head. My Hmong girls were married at 14 and then came back to school some. My Hmong boys were in gangs. The counselor, the psychiatrist, psychologist, the school nurse does a whole lot of counseling. And a lot of kids spend a lot of time in the nurse's office because they've got a hangnail and they need to talk to somebody. But these are invaluable resources. Please maintain the effort.
Any further testimony from or questions or comments from members of the committee? Representative Depke, do you wish to give a closing statement, or would you and hear my opinion afterwards, or do you want to hear my opinion beforehand and then you give your closing statement? Which one do you want?
I'd be happy to hear your opinion first.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair.
Well, Representative Depke and members of the committee, I think we heard some very passionate arguments on both sides of this issue. And I think when we asked individual school districts what sort of behavior they would engage in, we got some different answers. Some said they'd like to look at reducing them, some would like to stay where they're at, and some would like to increase them. And the reality is, if we pass this bill, that's probably what's going to happen, is individual school districts are going to make their own decisions about how it best impacts their districts. And I think that I think that that's my opinion on this issue. And Representative Depke, did you want to offer any closing statement on this?
I do, because I want to make it very clear that the effort in this bill is not against kids. I appreciate, and I'm very sensitive to both sides of the aisle that have been involved in education as long as we all have. Those of us who've served on school boards, those of us who have been working for kids for many years in and outside the classroom. And this bill in no way is anything that says we don't care about kids. And as a school board member, I remember that we made special efforts to hire counselors and to start many of the things that are in the Safe Schools levy, even before the state legislature and their wisdom told us to do that. And I have every faith in our local school boards and our local people and our superintendents. I haven't met any that don't care about kids, but they are struggling with decisions. And what bothers me the most is the fact that they had an opportunity to hire more personnel, whether it's teachers or counselors, even if it was for temporary funding. It whether it was a counselor or for a teacher, they knew that that money was going to go away. So it could have been the new teacher that they hired that was going to get fired too. That doesn't mean that that new teacher is any less important or more important than a counselor. But I think we need to let our local school districts make the decision in this area, and I have every confidence that they will continue to do the unfunded mandate as much as they possibly can with the money that we're giving them. And yes, they're very grateful for that $30 per pupil, because it does allow them to make some decisions in the Safe Schools area, and it's not necessary, you know, it's for everyone that's in that particular aspect, and they go above and beyond that for other personnel too. So I want that to be said. Thank you very much, and I appreciate your consideration. I appreciate every single person's comment, because I think that we all have different opinions, but it doesn't in any way mean that we don't still all work together for what's best for the kids in this state.
Thank you, Representative Nepke. And I have heard the voice of God, as often happens, and the voice of God tells me that this bill needs to go to the Tax Committee. So, Representative Loon, I assume that you want to modify your original motion so that this bill be recommended to pass and referred to the Tax Committee. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr.
Thank you, Representative Loon. A roll call being requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Representative Garofalo.
Yes.
Representative Kelly. Representative Anderson.
Yes.
Representative Enzel.
No.
Representative Bills.
Yes.
Representative Reinert?
No.
Representative Dabney?
No.
Representative Dietrich?
Yes.
Representative Downey?
Yes.
Representative Erickson?
Yes.
Representative Fabian?
Yes.
Representative Greiling?
No.
Representative Loon?
Yes.
Representative Mariani?
No.
Representative Myra?
Yes.
Representative Peterson?
Yes.
Representative Kwan?
Yes.
Representative Slocum?
No.
Representative Ward?
No.
Representative Woodard?
Yes.
There being 13 votes in favor, 7 against, the motion is passed, and House File 88 is referred to the Tax Committee. Thank you, Representative Depke. 12 to 7, excuse me. Members just... that's right. We have a testifier still for a session for legislative priorities. Mr. Lundell from Equity in Education, please come on down. And Mr. Lundell, I just want to remind you, as well as those in the audience, that tomorrow is School Spirit Day. Members, tomorrow is School Spirit Day in the Education Finance Committee. The expectation of the chair is that members of the public, as well as staff and members and committee assistants and pages, will be showing their school spirit tomorrow, so the chair will look most unfavorably on those who do not obey. Representative Reinert.
Mr. Chair, you should have given us an email reminder. Being from out of town, I neglected to bring my spirit gear, and it's back in Mankato, so I apologize, but I will not be showing my school spirit.
Representative Reinert, there are university schools around that would sell Mankato gear, and if you need something from Mankato, I got some stuff from college I can share with you. But Representative Woodard, if it's brief, we want to make sure we don't
Brief, and I just wanted to add that Belle Plaine has a couple of extra sweatshirts that I'll bring.
Very good.
Thank you, Mr.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell, Executive Director of Schools for Equity in Education. And is it high school or college colors I should be wearing tomorrow?
Mr. Lundell, I think that we there's broad discretion. School spirit is the
well, just don't make me sing the Augie War song.
Okay. I would not sentence the members of the committee to that. Mr. Lundell.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell with Schools for Equity and Education. Very, very happy to be here today to briefly go over our platform and priorities for the coming legislative session. Of those of you who are new to this committee, I tend to, you know, kill a couple of trees every time I come in. I tried to cut back today. I can, if you want to, you know, lot in your recycling, just talk to me and I'll bring you a lot of stuff. So, I think the thing is that Schools for Equity and Education, we've been around since 1979. We originally were organized under a group called the Association of Stable or Growing School Districts. At that time in state's history, most of the schools in the state were declining as the baby boom graduated. We were the school districts that were steady or growing. That has generally been the case in the organization. While we have now see that we are declining probably at the same rate or in the same proportion as other districts in the state, we do have the districts that are many of the districts who are still growing have pressures on local property taxes for building as well as for operations. The other thing that has bound us together then and binds us together now is the relatively low levels of property wealth that Schools for Equity and Education districts have. We fall well below the state average in terms of property wealth per pupil. For the most part, we do have a couple districts that have property values above the statewide average, but those are districts in the metro area who have lower property wealth than their neighboring or adjacent districts. So when there's pressure on property taxes, it tends to be a way that our it tends to be a pool in which our districts do not swim very well. That has always been, and what we've worked on over the last 15 to 18 years has been the referendum equalization program, the debt service equalization program. Equalization does not mean equal dollars per student. Equalization means equal effort generating equal dollars in property tax revenue. In other words, going from district to district, if I, you know, go one unit of property tax effort, I get one unit of revenue. What we have in the case in the state now is you'll have some districts getting maybe for one half increment of effort, they may be getting 1.5 increments of revenue, and vice versa. You may have districts that have high revenue, high property wealth that can generate fairly high amounts of revenue with low effort. What we've done over the last 20 years is we've worked to equalize those programs. And again, equalization was part of the general education program back then and is no longer part of the general education program because the general education program is paid for by all state aid. We talk now about the referendum and the debt service equalization or the debt service levies as being ones levies where one district may have far more potential for yield on an increment of effort, and that varies greatly from district to district. Also, the districts that in Schools for Equity and Education in the general education formula are districts that are very highly reliant on the general education formula as opposed to the categoricals. We are districts that don't have a lot of diversity. We are districts that aren't geographically isolated. So sparsity, compensatory, ELL. ELL, I should say, is a little bit different for us because we do have several districts amongst our regional centers that do have heavy participation in English language learner programs. But our districts are very heavily reliant on the general education formula. And a little over a decade ago, there was kind of, we think, a movement away from general education first, categorical second, to categoricals first, general education second. And we want to find a balance for that and certainly want to make the general education revenue a program that we believe meets the needs of the average child in the state, and then with categoricals and referenda kind of going above that. We think there's far much too much reliance on the referenda, and we think that the categorical system could be adjusted somewhat. I want to caveat by saying that we don't believe we should just, you know, back up the trucks to districts that get high levels of compensatory aid and just start, you know, spreading that money throughout the state. Those districts have unique needs. We'd like to move forward and again balance things out moving forward as opposed to dismantling the system as it exists right now. With that, there's just a couple of things I would like to go over the handouts that I gave out to you that show why equalization or re-looking at equalization is very, very important as we move into the future. We realize the one problem with equalization is it takes state money to fix. And when we're looking down the barrel of a $6.2 billion deficit, we realize that getting state money for equalizing referendum and debt service is probably something that's going to be difficult to do. I do think, though, that we may want to look at what's happening with the local government aid, because those reduced property taxes as well. And as we balance those issues as we're moving forward, maybe some of those dollars can be used for referendum and debt service as opposed to local government aid as it is being done right now. If you look at this history, this one single sheet here called the History of Referendum Equalization, and shows that the Referendum Equalization Program was established in the 1991 legislature for Pay 92, which is Fiscal 93. And at that time, the equalization made up 5%. That would be the state contribution to the referendum. Total revenue was 5%. Changes to the equalization program and greater utilization of the referendum kicked that up to 35% in Pay 2000, which was the fiscal 2001. Since that time, and there's a variety of reasons for doing that. The equalization rates stayed the same, but more and more, greater portions of the referendum were equalized. Went from 315 to 415 to 500 to 600 to 700, and where we're at now with current law is that the first $700 of the referendum is fully equalized. That means that by the state formula, the equalizing factor determines how much aid, if you qualify for aid, how much aid will be kicked in by the state to balance off or to provide enhanced effort for taxpayers locally. We've seen that then now dwindle to where we're back down to where we have over $825 million of total referendum revenue, and only 8% of that is covered by the referendum equalization program. There is another $8.5 million that's in what's called that tax-based replacement aid. That was put in the law as part of Governor Ventura's big plan in 2001, because when the ag land was taken off the referendum property value for districts that were very high ag, very isolated districts that had very high levels of agricultural property that were contributing greatly to the local referendum, the state kicked in to make up that loss of the ag land going off the property tax. Some of the largest referenda in the state are small districts that are have very much dominated by agricultural property. You'll see that then if you go to this two-page, how this plays out, you'll see that the state average property wealth has grown, and it's now that the state average property wealth exceeds the equalizing factor. That black bar to the right of the state average is the equalizing factor of $476,000 of referendum market value per pupil. So right now, the average district in the state, if a district in the state had average property wealth, they would be getting no state aid participation on their referendum. As you'll see, these were the ratios going forward, the corresponding ratios to that growth in referendum market value, to see that the last time that the state average generated, or the district with state average market value was Pay 2007, was the last time that those districts received state aid in their referendum. We believe that, you know, as part of what we're trying to accomplish, again, it takes state revenue to do this, and it probably takes a whole look at the property tax system in general, and something that I'm sure that Representative Runbeck will be working on as we move forward, to look at where does the property tax fit in education. Should it be made more income sensitive? Should we look at whole different ways of doing business property tax and the way that we do them now? But again, those are questions that are kind of outside the purview of this committee, but we just wanted to show that for those levies on referendum market value or adjusting that tax capacity show that these formulas have not been adjusted to match property growth that's taken place with the growth in property value over the last 20 years. We certainly think that it's time that we look at that again and look at that fully realizing that there's probably going to we'll have to wait until money's available to do that, because where we're at right now, we're getting back to the point where districts in the state are we're dangerously close to where we were in the late 60s, not to the extent, but we have many districts now with lower property tax, a lower property tax bite with higher revenue and a higher property tax bite with lower revenue. And I think that's something that as we move forward, we have to balance that out. Because even though this sometimes looks like property tax relief, it's property tax relief that leverages dollars for students. Again, you go back to this sheet, and you see that 65% of the districts in the state, when the referendum equalization program came into effect, only 65% of the districts in the state had a referendum. Now we're at 90%. If there had been no equalization, my guess is that 90% level would not be there. It would have never reached 90%. Now we can say, is that a good thing or is that a bad thing? And I think that's a debate that this committee can rightly have. Does this show that the referendum is a good thing for doing excess levy types of things, or has this really become part of the base? Is this more of an operating levy as opposed to an excess levy? And that's a question I think that's really appropriate for this committee to talk about, and we certainly want to join in that conversation and put our perspectives in place. Other than that, moving from the equalization, if you look at the rest of our platform, we do want to talk about the Constitution this year. And we talked about two things there with the Constitution, something similar to the Legacy Amendment, with the repeal of general education revenue, general education levy back in as part of Governor Ventura's big plan. Can I call him Jesse? Please don't touch my body, Ventura.
Your testimony, your call.
Anyway, the Legacy Amendment, we think, is that there needs to be a form of with the general education levy was gone, there's no real funding stream or a solid funding stream for education. We believe that having some kind of dedicated revenue would be good for that. We've got two pieces here. One is something similar to the Legacy Amendment, where a state sales tax increase, as voted on by the populace, would go for education. The other is a similar provision to what Arizona did last year. Last May, Arizona passed a temporary 1 cent sales tax increase to avoid cuts in education and health and human services. We think that that's something that is worth investigating as well. The next thing on the list is the state authorized fiscal emergency plan. We support the mandate repeal today, you know, like we did. We testified today on Representative Depke's bill. We testified on January 15th the other day. I think that it would be this kind of almost comes in as a middle ground position. We would just soon see many of the mandates repealed. If they are not repealed, we believe that an if-then system should be created, that if a certain set of circumstances exist, then mandates would be suspended for a given period of time. So if the state borrows money from school districts under 127A.45, perhaps in those year that would happen, that January 15th would go away for the next biennium, any number of mandates could be repealed, maybe something like the allowing districts to renew their referenda within that time frame as well. But some kind of an if this, then that, I think is, you know, at least a middle ground position. But again, we would prefer mandates be repealed. Last but not least, we would like to talk about in our equity quest for equity, there are many different levels of service that exist throughout the state. And one thing that we were talking about, this comes from a bill that was the Senate introduced back in 2007, is to have a statewide inventory of educational opportunities that exist for students throughout the state. We think that, I think once upon a time people looked at districts saying, well, they have this and we don't have that. Ergo, they're bad, we're good, we're the noble folks, the noble poor here. I think that we've kind of gone beyond that. We want to see what exists and how that sets up in conjunction with how that sets up with what the state's goals might be. We have great opportunity to make systems more portable than we did 10 years ago. And if a program exists in one district that could be somehow exported around the state through technology, it would be a good thing to know. We've worked a little bit with the Regional Education Laboratory, the federal from the Federal Department of Education out of Chicago, talking about this. They would be interested in doing something like this. The problem is that when they call up someone and say, what do you have in your system, they don't get very good answers. I think what we're looking for is some kind of legislative direction for districts to work with the that federal department to make sure that some kind of roster or some kind of list of services exists so that we know throughout the state what does exist and what can be shared, you know, to make, you know, kind of raise all boats. With that, I'll stand for any questions that you might have. Certainly look forward to working with all of you. For those who I have not worked with in the past, I look forward to meeting with you. Those who I represent or who represent school districts with which I work, I greatly want to, you know, build a strong bond of working relationship with you, and hopefully we can do that.
Thank you. And I have a question for Mr. Strom really quickly. Just the equalizing factor on the first $700 referendum, I think, is $476,000. What is the second tier of equalization beyond that?
Mr. Chair, the second tier goes basically to the amount of, with some very special circumstances, goes to the amount of the school district's total referendum that's in that tier, and the equalizing factor is $270,000.
And just, Mr. Lendell, if I'm understanding your chart right here, you're saying that we said no one qualifies for the 476 right now? Is that what this...
Mr. Chair, if a district at the state average, with state average property wealth, if you know, if you had the state as a whole and said, here's your property wealth, the state would, you know, if it was one big district that wouldn't qualify for equalization.
I understand. Representative Peterson, Papa Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lundell, speaking of one of your member districts, I represent Anoka Hennepin as well as Representative Dietrich. Equity in education can mean different things for different people. Can you talk about the compensatory funding formula and your C's position on that? Are you opposed to reforming that, in favor of? Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Mr. Lundell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Peters, Representative Peters.
Whoa, easy there.
Sorry about almost demoting you, Representative.
Good recovery.
As I said in my testimony, we are districts for, we have some districts that have fairly high concentrations of compensatory, but most of our districts are districts that are heavily reliant on the general education formula. We have supported over the years adjustments for districts with high levels of compensatory, you know, concentrations. I think where we're having our problems is we believe that the balance, there needs to be some balance restored, in that the general education revenue needs to be a greater, it's the locomotive of the system. We think the locomotive is too small right now. I think what, as I characterize this, is that I think in the late 80s to the early 90s, we tried to go to an average cost funding formula that tried to treat every child the same, and then look at those pockets where there are higher concentrations and, you know, zero in on those at a level that was further out than where it is right now. I mean, clearly the averages, the problems that you, or the challenges they have in the urban core, in some of the outstate areas, certainly are beyond what we experience and see, and certainly have there's a need there for you know, adjustments in the formula to meet that. But we think also at the same time and see that that general education formula, and I think it's reflected probably most compellingly by the increased use of the referendum, is that the general education formula is not enough. I think my main concern, and this kind of, we are for reforming compensatory, we are for, you know, but we think that there also the basic has to go up at the same time. We also don't believe that money should just be, you know, yanked out of systems. There's going to have to be some kind of hold harmless or transition. But I think, as if you look, the one problem that we've had along with compensatory or along categorical imbalances, that when the big plan, Governor Ventura's big plan, took place, that took the property tax and took it from a system that kind of treated everybody the same, or was kind of blanketed the state in a equal way, and now that's been kicked out into where it's random, where if you go on North Branch, for instance, they're probably going to have a very difficult time ever passing a referendum. Okay. Representative Erickson's district has very low levels of referendum, and it's very, very difficult for them to pass a referendum. When the categoricals, when the general education formula is not there at an amount, these differences, like with the categorical formula, start to show up more.
Mr. Lindell, we have two more questions, and we're actually over time right now, so I'm going to go really quickly.
But I would say, yes, we want to work with you on reform the compensatory. We don't want to just willy-nilly go after Minneapolis, St. Paul, and other districts.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lindell, I would like to thank you for bringing this legislative platform forward. The one thing that I have seen that I think is unique about this platform is that you have at least, whether you agree with them or not, sought some solutions to education funding in the state. And I greatly appreciate that, and I look forward to the day when we are all having that conversation. Education funding has gone down for the first time in many years, and I think that that needs to be the focus of the stakeholders in this room, that are in this room a lot of times. And I appreciate the fact that you have done that. And so my question is, have you been able to create any energy around any of these platform statements to get these things done, to start talking about it? Because when I think of the legacy amendment, that took a lot of stakeholders sitting around and talking and assessing the situation of environmental, state-funded environmental funding for a long time, and that is the way that it got energy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dietrich, I'm surprised we're having a little bit of trouble generating energy around the constitutional questions at this point.
Okay.
For a variety of reasons.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Lindell. I think this is a long conversation, and I won't belabor the point. I think your answer to Representative Peterson's question is really where we need to get to, and we need to look at a way that we can eliminate some of these funding discrepancies. If you look at my districts, Belle Plaine, Northfield, they're a good $5,500 to $6,000 less per pupil than what Minneapolis-St. Paul gets. And I understand your point about taking away from Minneapolis to give to everybody else, but it's a conversation we need to have, and we won't have it right now, but I did want to thank you for starting the conversation. I think there's a lot to talk about on this particular issue. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Representative Woodard, we certainly want to have, and I think that, you know, Representative Greiling and her leadership when she was chair, when we talked about PS Minnesota and other things, realizing that we've been talking about this for about a half decade now, and I think that we kind of know where all the fence posts are, and we need to start talking about what's inside the fence. And I think that certainly want to work with you, with the chair, and other members of this committee to have, you know, earnest conversation regarding how we can make the system work.
Thank you, Mr. Lindell. Members of the committee, we are adjourned. Thank you.